Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming back for part three of Origins of the Oral Torah. And I hope you've been enjoying the class thus far. Last time, we explored different views about the origins of machloket, or dispute, and how did that come to be? How did there come to be so much of it? We talked about the view of the Gaonim, that everything was given at Har Sinai, but the reason for a subsequent dispute was that either the students didn't learn from their teachers so well, or they forgot. We explored the Rambam's view, which was that really some things, many things were given at Har Sinai, but many things also developed later as products of drash, of rabbinic interpretation and extrapolation from the text of the Torah itself. We explored the Ramban's broad conception of rabbinic authority, and when we closed by looking at the Ritva and the Ran, the Rishonim, who felt that Machloket was kind of built into revelation from the get-go. That there was, revelation was multifaceted, and the rabbis, again, were given the authority to sort of choose among opinions as time went on. So there was some flexibility present there. This class, I want to shift gears a bit, and we're going to jump forward several hundred years in this historical survey, and we're going to get to the Enlightenment. And in the Enlightenment, there were new developments in how people thought about drash, rabbinic interpretation, and creativity, and there were some new problems that had to be addressed. And what I'm talking about is that the Enlightenment was all about reason. It was all about natural law. It was all about criticizing that which was received. And some of the criticism spilled over into things about the Torah itself. Sort of the big issue writ large sometimes was about people challenging, you know, the divinity of the Torah itself. Was it really given to Moshe on Har Sinai at all? We're not going to talk about that. That's a whole other issue. But that became an issue in the 18th and 19th centuries. But what I do want to talk about is some criticism, particularly of Torah Shebaal Peh, or the Oral Torah, that also happened during that time period. And what I want to start with was a Reform rabbi, Rabbi Abraham Geiger, who lived in the 19th century. He was an important figure in German Reform. And one of the things he was trying to do, which was something that other people were trying to do as well, he says, there's been a lot of rabbinic interpretation and opinions over the years. Let's try to sort of get down to what the essence of Judaism is. Let's strip away those layers, which he felt and others felt were extraneous, and let's try to figure out what is the core concern of Judaism? What is the ethical, moral center of the religion? And if we can figure that out, he says, we'll be a lot better off. And this was something that was very, as I said, was very popular at the time. So let me share my source sheet so we can see exactly what he says about rabbinic interpretation that will help frame our class going forward and see how Orthodox rabbis responded to his concerns. Okay, here we have the source sheet. Let me enlarge it. All right, there we go. So if we look at source number one over here, this is Abraham Geiger writing in German in 1841, disturbed by the relationship of the natural meaning of scripture to Talmudic scriptural exegesis, which in other words is basically when Chazal, when our rabbis, when the sages are interpreting the Torah, and they're coming up with new drashot, and we saw some of these drashot in the past classes, trying to figure out how we know certain things from the text of the Torah itself, what exactly are they doing, and does it make any sense? And Geiger says, no, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense in many cases. He says, words and letters were interpreted in the most arbitrary way. Analogies were found in the most accidental and contingent similarities, which then justified the complete transference of legal consequences from one text to another. One literally set out to look for, and to some extent produce, anomalies and superfluities in the relevant passages in order to connect them with interpretations to which they could not truly be related, even if there really were an anomaly present. So what Geiger is upset about is that sometimes it seems when the rabbis are darshaning, when the rabbis are interpreting the Torah, it's not that logical. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense that this particular difference in wording or this particular extra letter would actually mean what the rabbis say it would mean. And I think there are, I think on a certain level, we can understand some of his concerns, even if we may not agree with them. Because it does sometimes seem like rabbinic exegesis, rabbinic interpretation, is a little hard to always figure out exactly what they're pinning things on and whether that really makes sense to a certain type of logic or a certain type of rational reading of the text. I mean, the only example I'll just give is the one we actually looked at in the first class a little bit. We talked about how Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael were disputing about the certain punishment meted out to the daughter of a Kohen who commits adultery. And the change in punishment was going to be, because the word was said ve'et, it was an extra vav instead of just et without the vav. And like, one might wonder, you know, well, so, and we talked about, you know, is this something that was passed down that they interpret that way? Was it they were actually learning out new laws for that interpretation? But I guess either way, the question is, is that rational? Is that logical? And does that even matter? But Geiger at least says it does matter. And he's very bothered by this fact that a lot of rabbinic interpretation does not seem so logical. If we look at source number two, Samuel Holdheim, another Reform rabbi in the 19th century, and he was very interested in reforming halacha, as many of the reformers were at that time. And he wanted to sort of get Judaism down to those few principles that would rest on reason and conscience. It's very, very, very much in the style of the Enlightenment and what they were doing. He wrote a book, a sefer, in 1860 called Ma'amar Ha'ishut. He was discussing different approaches to marriage. In particular, he was trying to compare the approach of the rabbis and the Karaites. We talked a little bit last time about the Karaites. These were a group in the early medieval period in Babylonia and other places who were saying that we don't believe in Torah Shabbat Peh. We don't believe there was an oral tradition going back. We have our own way of interpreting the text that we're going to use, which is not going to be the same way the rabbis did it. And so here, Holdheim, the scholar, is sort of reinvigorating the Karaites' approach, and he's trying to show why he thought their way of reading the text was better. And he says, Ki derech acheres yesh lahakara'im bedrash, mishuna betiv'a v'tzurasa min derech harabanim. That they interpreted, the rabbis and the Karaites interpreted the text in different ways. It says, Harabanim yamiku al kavanat haktuvim, v'akra'im al kavanat kotvam. That the rabbis delve into the intent of the writings, and the Karaites delve into the intent of their writer. Harabanim yachteru leida inyanam v'karaim yivakshu das v'ratzon nosnam. The rabbi struggles to know their substance. The Karaites seek the will and desire of their giver. Harabanim hachoku neged enei harabanim. The rabbis are concerned with the law. Hamechokek neged enei hakaraim. The Karaites are concerned with the legislator. Harabanim yifarshu as haTorah be'ezer haklalim shem chutzim la. The rabbis use these external principles, like these 13 principles we talked about of interpretation, and he says the Karaites interpret the Torah through the Torah itself, with principles on which the Torah's fundamentals were based. So we're seeing a very similar concern by Holdheim to what Geiger said, that things are just not logical. He says this rabbinic interpretation is often based on external factors. It's also not completely clear what they're doing. He thinks it's this is a very radical claim. He thinks it's lacking a certain level of godliness, that they're not concerned enough with what God actually wanted, and that the rabbis are kind of interpreting on their own. And again, these are very strong critiques. These are very strong critiques at the time, and it bothers a lot of Orthodox rabbis at the time, the Orthodox movement, which is sort of developing in tandem, this idea that we need to respond to reform, that these people are raising these critiques and trying to challenge the divinity of the Torah, the divinity of rabbinic interpretation of halacha, and they felt the need. There was a need for a strong response to these types of claims. So let me just pause here for a moment before I get to some of the responses and see if there are any questions. I'll start with the chat. Let's see. Nothing in the chat right now. Does anyone want to raise anything, or should we jump into the responses and see how people address this?
So thinking about Daniel Lasker and his approach to the Karaites, mm-hmm. is giving me a different, you know, an alternate view of the Karaites.
Sure.
You could say they are too. They have their own Torah Sheval Peh. Mm-hmm. It's not that they don't discount any oral interpretation. Mm-hmm. They have a different Masorah.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be, you know, they're not heretics. They're just different.
Right, absolutely. I think that's I haven't like myself read Lasker's book yet, although I do want to at some point. But yeah, I mean that's what I've learned as well, that in reality the Karaites are, it was often oversimplified in the past, and people would say, oh, the rabbis had the oral Torah, the Karaites didn't believe in the oral Torah. Well, the Karaites kind of had their own oral interpretation, because it isn't really possible to interpret the text solely from the text itself. So I think maybe like views of people like Holdheim are somewhat outdated. And I don't want to get into a whole discussion of this, A, because I'm not fully qualified to discuss it, but B, I don't think it's directly relevant to our question about what the Karaites believed. But my point is just to show that people like Holdheim were upset with rabbinic interpretation at this time, and they felt that it was not logical, and they were trying to grapple with what we do with what they believed was an illogical way of interpreting the Torah.
Can I just say, the main problem with the Karaites was not exegetical. It was that both at the time of Sadia Gaon and then later with Ibn Ezra, sorry to bring him up again, they were a political threat. They were a political threat to the powers that be. And they try. And Ibn Ezra felt they were going to the Spanish authorities when he was there, just like people went and attacked Malbim later on in Russia. It was more a sociological, political thing. And I don't think this comes out in Daniel Lasker's book, frankly. It's more about exegesis and how to look at it. But there's a woman called Colette Sirah, who is French, who has written a very good book on history of medieval Jewish philosophy. It's in English as well as French. And she is a real authority. And she is sociological and political is also very important for a tiny minority. Believe me, living in diaspora, you know. So that was the main thing.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's very interesting. I heard about that book also, and have not read it. It sounds interesting. And yeah, I've definitely heard about at least the challenge the Karaites posed to the hegemony of the Gaonim in Bavel. I was not as aware of, you know, their any work they did in Spain about the authorities. So thank you for letting me know about that. I was not aware of that. But sure. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about some of these solutions. And now I'll tell you at the outset, I don't know that like we're going to solve anything today. I don't know that like we're going to say, oh, you know, well, this is like the way that we know that the rabbis were right in all their interpretations, and that everything they did was extremely logical. But I'm more interested sort of from a historian's perspective, just to look at the way people felt at the time that needed to be responded to. And maybe that will give us some grounding going forward for thinking about how we might think about this differently. Let's jump into it. So we'll start with Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch, as you probably heard of, another 19th century German rabbi, very much against the reform movement. And he spent a lot of his time actually fighting against the reform. I mean, he's very well known for his broad-mindedness in terms of that he was okay with people learning secular studies, and he borrowed from literature and all sorts of stuff like that. But he's also really very important as a combatant of the reform movement, and he felt that the Orthodox community needed to separate in its entirety from the reform community, and that they couldn't sort of be sort of two rabbis in the same town with equal authority, essentially, like running the community. He really wanted to establish separate Orthodox communities, and he felt that was important at the time for Germany and for Orthodoxy to survive. So anyway, without getting into too much detail about that either, I just want to talk about some of the things he says in his Torah commentary about the issue of Torah Shebaal Peh and the origins of the Torah Shebaal Peh and rabbinic creativity. And Rav Hirsch is noting something here in this passage. He also was writing originally in German, so I have here an English translation. This is a bit of an old English translation also. But he's noting that the Torah often speaks in particulars, that the Torah doesn't give you a lot of general principles when it gives you laws. So, for example, how do the laws start off in Parshat Mishpatim right after the giving of the Torah? They start off with the Hebrew slave, the Jewish slave. And Rav Hirsch is kind of bothered, as others are bothered, like, why do we start here? Like, why is this the starting point for how you want to present all the laws? It's such a specific case. It's a case that has some moral challenges to it as well. So Rav Hirsch's solution is as follows. He says, what a mass of laws and principles of jurisprudence must have already been set and fixed, considered, laid down and explained before the book of law could reach these or even speak of these, which after all are only quite exceptional cases. The book is not the real source of the Jewish conception of rights, if this source is the traditional law, which was entrusted to the living word, to which this book is only to be an aid to memory and reference when doubts arise. If, as indeed it is stated in this book itself, the total and complete law had been given over to the people in its complete form, and had been impressed upon them, and explained to them, and lived by them for 40 years before Moses, just before his death, was to hand them this written book, This book was to be given into the hands of those who were already well informed in the law, simply as a means of retaining and reviving ever afresh this knowledge which had been entrusted to their memories, and also to the teachers of the law as a means of teaching to which the students can go for references to the traditional actual laws, so that the written sentences lying before them would make it easy for them to recall to their minds the knowledge they had received orally. And to close, the written Torah is to be to the oral Torah in the relation of short notes on a full and extensive lecture on any scientific subject. So it's a bit of a mouthful. Does anyone want to jump in and tell me, what do you think? What is Rav Hirsch's response to the question of the oral Torah and its development?
There's a diminishment of the written Torah in order to achieve his reconciliation.
Sure. Yeah.
It's secondary to the oral Torah.
Secondary, right. Yeah. So I think Rav Hirsch is very interesting this way. So someone like Geiger will say, you know, Drash is illogical. And Rav Hirsch will say, well, maybe, but that Drash is not as important. Because as we kind of saw in the beginning with the position of the Gaonim, that everything was given at Har Sinai. And in fact, the Torah is almost, I don't want to call it secondary, but he's almost sounds like he's saying that. That the written Torah itself is not as important for the practice of Jewish law, at least, as the full oral Torah that they got at Har Sinai. It's almost like lecture notes. You know, you hear the main lecture, that's the Torah Shebaal Peh, that's the oral Torah. You write down the notes, that's the Torah Shebiksav. And I think in one way, this is a really good response, because he's basically saying that we don't have to worry so much about rabbinic interpretation. Why? Because, no, there was a full code already given by God at Har Sinai. Let me just finish this up. But on the other hand, I think this is very difficult, according to much of what we saw in previous classes. One, like, let's just say the Rambam's basic approach and all those that followed after him, that really the rabbis did create a lot of new things later, and that drash and rabbinic interpretation and what happened after Sinai was actually really important to the growth and development of halacha and the Torah Shebaal Peh. And then also, I think, secondarily, then, we also have this issue now that almost like a new issue that's come up in Rav Hirsch's approach, which is that what do we think about the fact that Torah Shebiksav is almost on like a secondary level, or almost in a way like not as important? That seems to the priorities seem to have shifted, at least conceptually, in Rav Hirsch's view, and the way that we've generally conceived of the written Torah versus the oral Torah. Yeah, was there a question?
Yeah, so but the problem is that it's based on a tautology. The idea is that it's based on a rabbinic teaching itself that the oral Torah precedes the written Torah. So you have a kind of rabbinic interpretation that backs up a rabbinic interpretation. It's a bit of a tautology, actually.
Okay.
From a logical perspective.
Okay, I hear that. That's a fair point. That's a fair point. I mean, on the other hand, when I presented this view to some people, they'll tell me that, oh no, this is not so strange. This is what we believe. I don't know. I agree with that necessarily, but like that we've all heard that like Torah Shebaal Peh. Yeah, sure. Torah Shebaal Peh is very important. And in fact, the way we started this very series, I gave you that quote in the very first class from Rabbi Joseph Elias in the Jewish Observer. And he was a student of Rav Hirsch. I mean, not directly, but he was from that German tradition that came through to Washington Heights, the Breuers in Washington Heights, where he was the member of the shul there, which really believed, I think, that very strongly in this approach, that Torah Shebaal Peh is all-encompassing and was handed down to Har Sinai. So I think Rav Hirsch has a strong traditional grounding, but I do think that because of some of the things we talked about last time, it can be a less satisfying approach to some of us. Anyone else want to say anything about Rav Hirsch? Any other questions, comments?
It seems to me that what he's saying is actually the drash, what we call rabbinic, is the reality, and the Torah is like the cribs notes, the table of contents, effectively. Which is expanded, that the expansion was what was actually given.
Right. I think that's what he's saying. I mean, I don't know. So not everyone agreed with the first, even within the very traditional camp, even among his contemporaries who were doing similar things to him. And that's why I want to bring up in source four over here, the view of the Malbim, of Meir Leibush ben Yechiel Mechel Weiser. Malbim is actually an acronym for Meir Leibush ben Yechiel Mechel. And he wrote a very important commentary on the Torah in the 19th century. He himself was a very interesting figure. He was also he was the rabbi in several different cities throughout his life, both in Eastern Europe and Western Europe. He was also combating reform and those tendencies similar to Rav Hirsch. Actually, just a little aside here, we talked at the end of the class last time about the chief rabbi of a New York position, how Rabbi Jacob Joseph went to New York to become the chief rabbi, and it didn't work out so well. So one of the people actually considered for that position was Malbim, and he did not go. Maybe that's for the best, I don't know, but he was elderly at the time and did not end up going.
Can I just say Rabbi Hirsch applied for England, and they chose an entity. It was a friend of Queen Victoria called Adler. You won't believe it. Rabbi Hirsch, you just spoke about, was going to be chief rabbi in England. And then they had his son who wanted to prevent all the people coming in from pogroms in 1903 and went to the coronation on Shabbat, which I've just written about. So he's not a very good role model because the Queen chose him and he didn't have any intellect. We've always had that in England. It's terrible. Sorry.
Okay, interesting. I don't know anything about that, but that also sounds like a really interesting historical episode there. So the Malbim is also very concerned with the same questions that Rav Hirsch is concerned with about the origin of Torah Shebaal Peh, how we connect the Torah Shebiksav, the written Torah, to the oral Torah. And in his commentary on the Torah, he does something a little different than many other commentators do. He does talk about, you know, the explanation of the verses themselves from a pshat level, from a plain meaning level, but he's also really, really interested in drash. And if you actually look at Sefer Vayikra, which oftentimes many commentators, that's the shortest book that they wrote, is the one on Sefer Vayikra, because, you know, Sefer Vayikra is a little more detailed, a little more halachic than other Sfarim. So the Malbim actually has two volumes on Sefer Vayikra, because what he does is he actually goes through the halachic midrashim, whether it's the Sifra or the Sifrei, the Mechota, depending on which Sefer of Chumash it is, and he actually comments on that. And his whole idea is like, how do we understand how the rabbis got their interpretations that we find in the Mishnah and the Gemara? How do they get that from the text of the Torah itself? And he's really, really interested in this question. And in his introduction to his commentary, he explains his methodology. And I think his methodology is really, really different than really anything anyone else was doing. So he first starts out in source number four in the part that's not bolded. He talks about some people say that you know, either the rabbis kind of made this up, or like it's not really a serious interpretive process because they already knew all the laws ahead of time. It was all passed down, and they're just using these asmachtos, they're just using these like eggs or supports for their laws. But he says this is wrong. If you look at the bolded part, he says, "V'zeh rachok ma'o." This is just very unlikely. Ki ra'inu shehem shalim tami minalecha mashiv mikra poni. Because in the Gemara all the time, the Gemara asks, "How do we know this?" And it says from this pasuk. But and someone else says, oh, but we use that pasuk for something else, so we can't use it for X. We already used it for Y. And they answer and they ask and they go back and forth about it. If everything that the rabbis are doing from these verses, from these pesukim, is just like a symbol or a hint, and it's not really learning it, why would they go so much in depth into this? And when there's an argument, everyone brings their own proof from the verse. And they disprove their friend. And the Talmud always goes back and forth, refining their positions to a hair's breadth. The Soster Ubona Machria Benam Ben Amikra builds and decides between them from the verse. Until it's clear the main proof is from the verse itself. Shasham notu halachos the gam shorsho. There the halacha is planted in root. It does not come like a root from a desolate land. So what Malbim is saying, and I think in this he's very much disagreeing with Rav Hirsch, and he's saying no. When the rabbis are grappling with the text, when they're trying to learn out laws from the text, they are actually learning out those laws from the text. And that's why the Gemara takes Rash so seriously as an enterprise. If it was just a sign, it was just a hint to something that pre-existing oral tradition, they would not be so invested in this. They would not be so invested in this process of figuring out what verse is used for what. So he says, no, they must have actually been learning things out from the verse. So then you have the question that we raised at the beginning of this class. So what do you do about the fact that it's not always logical? It doesn't always seem like we can move from point A to point B so clearly that we know why the rabbis use this verse for this purpose. So then he explains further. It says, Chazal haya b'yadim klalim gedolim v'yesodes kubuim b'darfei hadikduk v'yesodei halashon v'ahigayon. Chazal had great principles and established fundamentals in the way of grammar, language, and logic. Asher rubam na'almu v'nistru me'ein kochach me'lavav habayim achreim. Most of them were hidden from all the wise people who came after them. Their ways were forgotten and their paths unknown. I've shown and clarified wondrously and reliably that the drash is a simple pshat that is evident and contained in the text of the fundamentals of the Hebrew language. Behold, the oral Torah is written explicitly in God's Torah. Okay, so anyone want to jump in here and tell me what is the Malbim saying and why? What is so novel and interesting about his approach?
He's the original textualist. He's getting back to basics. I mean, he sounds like the story they tell about the Vilna Gaon, that when he was very ill or old. And he would just have the mikra in front of him, mm-hmm. as he learned that everything was there, and he was, you know, that's all he needed was the text itself. So,
he's certainly a textualist, but I think there's more going on here too. I think he's saying that you think the rabbis' drashot don't seem logical. That's because you don't know what they're doing. That they're not that really everything they're doing is based on principles of grammar, principles of language. That when we see like these 13 midot of interpretation, like gzeira shava, kavachom, or all these different things, we can't just look at those alone. But we have to look at what's behind those. He says there's an entire other system of interpretation, a grammatical system of interpretation that lies behind those principles. And what we only sort of see on the surface is not really what the rabbis are doing. And he says, but how do we know these principles of interpretation? Where do they come from? And he says, well, they were passed down in some way, or they were at least known to the rabbis in some way, but we've forgotten it, and I've rediscovered them. And I think this is really fascinating, because he's basically saying that for a long time, we didn't understand what Chazal were doing, until we come up with these grammatical principles, and now we can understand what they're doing. Essentially, they're lost. I mean, I didn't quote all his language here, but he's basically saying that these principles of interpretation, these sort of what's really behind the 13 midot, these principles of grammar were lost and rediscovered. And actually in another work called Yalat HaShachar, which was at the beginning, I think it's usually printed at the beginning of his commentary, he lists all these different principles of interpretation that he uses. And in fact, he comes up with the number 613. That just like the mitzvot in the Torah, there are 613 principles of grammar, principles of logic, and he uses these principles. And he goes throughout his commentary going back and forth trying to figure out how to apply each of these principles and how to show that really everything that Chazal did was logical. So I think in one way, this is incredibly clever. He's responding to someone like Geiger and he's saying, you think that what Chazal are doing is not logical, but that's because you're sort of just looking at it at face value. You're not delving into it. You're not looking at all the grammatical principles, the principles of language and logic that underlie everything they were doing. On the other hand, I think one could just as easily say this is too clever, because how do we know that he's right about this? No one really said this before, that there were all these principles of interpretation that are underlying the 13 principles of interpretation, and that without them we can't understand the Torah. And so it's almost like he's pulling something new out of thin air, in a way. He's not necessarily claiming, he doesn't have a good source for his claim that there were all these other principles of interpretation that Chazal were using. So I think that's like the pro and the con kind of the Malbim's view here. Let me see if there are any questions in the chat here. Okay, there's some discussion about the coronation. I'm not going to get into that right now. Feel free to talk about that later, though. Any other questions about Malbim or comments about Malbim's view or anything that's unclear? Okay. In that case, let me move on a little bit. So we talked to we just said that Malbimzi was really interesting and really new, but also kind of difficult because he's kind of creating new principles of interpretation. And he was criticized for this as well by others. An interesting figure that criticized him was Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines. Rav Reines was a rabbi in Lida, which is in modern day Belarus, in the late 19th, early 20th century. He was important for, he's not super well known today, but he was important for a number of reasons. One is that he was a Zionist, a very traditional rabbi who was a Zionist. He started the Mizrahi party within the Zionist Congress in 1902. He also started a yeshiva in 1905 in Lida, which taught secular studies in addition to the traditional Gemara learning. And that was something that was also very new. So he was somewhat of a revolutionary in his time, and he wrote a number of svarim. I've actually written a couple of academic papers about him some years ago now, but exploring both like his approach to his yeshiva and his approach to Torah Shebaal Peh, which is what I want to talk about very briefly right now. He wrote this work called Chotem Tochnit, in which he also was trying to respond to the problems caused by reform that we mentioned. How does Drash really make sense? That's what really exercised him in this sefer. And the first thing he says is, He's very bothered by reform's approach, but he also criticizes Malbim. Now, he doesn't criticize Malbim by name, but it's very clear he's referring to his approach. He talks about a rabbi who says that who had all these grammatical rules. And he says he often invented these rules, though, and they often lack any logical foundation. He says grammatical principles are not always rational, but are rooted in the unique properties of each and every language. And he said there was often no demonstration of the grammatical rule except the very rabbinic statements that was being explained. And Rav Reines found that unacceptably circular. So he's going to come up with a new approach. He's rejecting Malbim's approach about grammar and language, and he comes up with another approach, which in some ways is similar, but in some ways is different. And he says over here in source number 5, Ki al pi haklali mahagyonim hamekubalim sha'avu chazal kol mishpatei ha'alachos mimayan hakadosh shel Torah shebikta. By way of logical transmitted principles, the sages obtained all the halachic rules from the holy spring of the written Torah. Daki ha'yesod harashi b'chol ha'Torah shebaal peh v'yichusav la'Torah shebikta v'ruach ha'chaya b'chol ofanah hu ha'yediyah la'hafshida kochos ha'penimiim. The cornerstone of the entire oral Torah and its relationship to the written Torah is the ability to determine the inner sustaining forces of a particular norm. V'lamud melechas hafshata b'tachlita hi la'asos min ha'pratim klalim. And the point of this method of extraction is to make principles from the particulars. V'zos hi tachlis hamidos shenimsur l'moshe mi'sinai. And this is the purpose of the hermeneutical principles, the yigil amidos that were given to Moshe at Sinai. Ki heim yilmudu be'eza ofa notzi ha'musagim ha'peniminim ve'eich la'asos min ha'pratim klalim. They are to instruct in the ways of deriving these internal ideas and how to make principles from particulars. So it's a little hard to tell from this quote, and it's kind of a very complex book and a complex sefer that he's trying to do, and I'm not sure I can do his ideas justice in this format or if I even fully understand everything he's getting at. But if we look at the Torah Shebikta, we look at the written Torah, it deals with a lot of very specific cases. And he says that those specific cases, though, are often based on broader logical principles. And just like a judge might have a case before him, like say an American court or something like that, and the judge makes a very specific ruling in that case, but that case might then teach us an awful lot about other cases. Like there may be some principle that comes out of that case that can then be applied elsewhere. And Rav Reines is saying that the rabbis kind of are doing the same thing, that the Torah has these very specific cases and the rabbis are moving things to a more general level and trying to come up with logical principles that can be grounded in the text itself. You have a pasuk which seems to indicate one rule. That rule then can then apply to other cases. So I think what he's saying is that when it comes to the Yud Gimel Midot, when it comes to these, they're not just, we can't take them at face value. So I think he's agreeing with Malbim on that there's something behind them. But what he believes is behind them is not language, not grammar, but logic, that there is a certain logical core to each of these and to the way they're used. And there we have then this larger toolbox of logical principles based on the original 13 principles that we see from the text of the Torah that we can then use to apply to a bunch of different cases. And some of the, and he talks in his book about what some of these principles are. Like we have some that are used late, much later on, like in learning and stuff like that. And he tries to systematize to some extent the logic of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Again, I don't know whether this works. I mean, number one, I don't know that like everything is as logical as he thinks it is. Number two, and I think the biggest problem with Rabbeinus's approach is, unlike Malbim, for example, who tried to show this, like Malbim actually went through the whole Torah and wrote a commentary explaining what principles of language are behind the rabbi's derivations. Rabbeinus never did that. He kind of gives this little introduction and he says there are all these logical principles, but he never really defines them fully. He never really explains how it works. So it's more of a conceptual idea maybe than something that he actually was able to apply. But I think the whole point is, again, he's very bothered by this question of how do we deal with the logic of the Torah Shebaal Peh, and his response is to come with a new approach where he says actually there is an internal logic. It's this internal logic of principles that are learned out of particulars. And I think for both the Malbim and Rav Reines, we've moved a great deal from our original ideas about the 13 principles of interpretation to the 13 principles being like a small part of a much larger system. So they almost take like a back seat. And I think one advantage from their perspective of their system is the 13 principles are kind of, you know, kind of one thing that maybe was given at one moment in time at Har Sinai. And both Rabbeinus and the Malbim are saying that, no, there's something timeless. There's something eternal that is behind these principles, whether it's language or logic or something of that sort. The question then still is, does that really work? Do we find either of these approaches convincing? So I know that was quite a bit. So again, I'll just pause here to take any questions anyone might have. Let me first attend to the chat. Ariel Siegel says Rabbeinus's manuscripts were donated to the National Library of Israel in 2020, and there are 88 manuscripts that have not been studied. Maybe there are more insights from Rabbeinus in the manuscripts. Yeah, so Rabbeinus only published a very small portion of what he wrote, actually, and there is much more in manuscript, and some of it has been studied more than others. A lot of the stuff has been looked at. A lot of the manuscripts, I believe, before that, if I'm not mistaken, were in Mosada Rav Kook, actually. And some scholars have looked at that stuff. I do think also, though, that it seemed to me, based on my research, that he had intended to write a much larger work where he kind of went through a lot of the Torah and a lot of Chazal, trying to explain how his system worked, how his system of logical interpretation worked, but that he never actually, it seems evident from the manuscript evidence, at least that I saw, was that he had not actually written it. But I think that's still not completely clear. But thank you for that comment, clarifying that. Are there any additional questions about either the Malbim or Rabbeinus or anything we've talked about so far?
Why do you think that they're different? They seem to be different, but they're both saying roughly the same sort of thing. There are logical principles in the Torah that have been there all the time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there were people around who had the insight to reveal those principles. The Malbim says, by looking at grammar, I have revealed certain principles. I see that. Rav Reines says, well, Chazal had also revealed principles by examining the text. They're, in a sense, they're saying a very similar kind of thing in principle.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Asher, I agree with you. I think that's why I put them together. I think their approaches are trying to do the same thing. They're trying to show there's something logical. There's some additional backing to what Chazal are doing. I think the specifics are different and they do disagree with each. I mean, Rabbeinus makes it very clear. He disagrees with the Malbim's approach of looking at language. But yeah, but I think in principle, they're doing the same thing, which is why I brought them together. So I think what we've seen up until now, we can even based on what Asher just said, I think we can call them almost two different approaches if we want to look at a big gadol, a big picture kind of. That Rav Hirsch, in responding to Reform, doubles down and says, no, they're saying that Chazal learned all these illogical things out of the text. No, everything was given at Har Sinai. There was nothing to be learned, essentially. And Ravinus and the Malbim are saying, no, there was a lot to be learned, but it was very logical what they were doing. It was based on something much, much bigger. And I think what I want to explore in the last approach is another way of dealing with the question, and maybe not even as explicitly dealing with the question, which is to say that, which is to say that maybe we can put less emphasis on fixed principles entirely or logic, and we can just say that we trust in the authority of Chazal. This is a kind of a move that we did see last time to a certain degree. That the answer to reform is not so much we have a way of explaining this, but that we believe that this is the way things are meant to turn out. We believe there is a power to chiddush, there is a power to new interpretation, and that the rabbis had the authority to make new interpretations based on the needs of the time. So let's dig into this a little bit. So here's an interesting source in source number 6. And this is a much larger discussion, but I think it's important to bring up for the for context what we're going to see in the Netziv, in source number 7. That we have been talking this whole time about 13 principles of interpretation. We have Rabbi Yishmael, we have a Braita, we have his teaching there, we even say it in the Siddur, that there are these 13 principles of interpretation. But this doesn't seem to be the only evidence we have of principles of interpretation in early rabbinic literature. Because in fact, in Tosefta here in Sanhedrin, we have only 7 principles, not 13. It says, Shiva Dvarim, Darash Hillel Hazakin Lipnei Ziknei Petera, that Hillel the Elder expounded 7 hermeneutical principles, and he lists them, Kal v'chomer, Gezei Rashava, Binyan Av, Kasuvecha Mishnei Kesuvim, Klal Oprat, Prat Oklal, Kiyotzevu, Makam Acher, V'davar Halam Me'inyano. So he lists 7 principles there. Elu Sheva Midos, Darash Hillel Hazak Nipnei Bar Binyan Petera. It says that Hillel taught only 7. So it's interesting here. So it's interesting here that instead of the 13 were very commonly associated with Rabbi Yishmael, it seems that we have Hillel earlier, an earlier Tana, having only 7 principles. So that then raises the question, how do we get from 7 to 13? Everyone was kind of saying, well, 13 were handed down at Har Sinai, but over here it sounds like maybe there were in an earlier stage in development, there were only 7 and not 13. So the Netziv, important 19th century figure, a commentator on the Torah, he wrote Ha'amek Davar in source number 7. He's dealing with this question about 7 to 13. And just to give a tiny bit of background on the Netziv, he was the Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva in Volozhin in the late 19th century. It was an important Yeshiva. I don't think that he directly was dealing with reform. There wasn't really reform in Eastern Europe to the same degree. There was Haskalah. There was sort of enlightenment, and people were kind of abandoning certain traditional norms, even within the Volozhin Yeshiva itself in that time. So it could be that was at least in the back of his mind in responding to sort of these challenges, but he wasn't explicitly dealing with that. But in his commentary over here, what he is interested in is, it says, the Torah says, Vishamarta v'asita, that when it comes to the doing, you should keep and do the Torah. And he's interested in sort of, I think, the use of the word v'asita, which means to do, but maybe could also mean to make. So he's interested, who exactly is making these laws? And if you look over here in the Hebrew, at the third line down the last word in source number 7, he says, "Ukamoshi yesh klalim lahotzi halachos leor al pi sheva midos shadara Hillel." And just like there are methods to bring halacha to light based on Hillel's 7 principles, "Kidatani b'tosefta b'Sanhedrin perek zayin v'achar kach hosifu aleihem tana de Rabbi Shmuel v'shana yudgimel midos." Afterwards, only later, Rabbi Shmuel taught 13 principles. "V'chol zeh hotziu min halachos mekubal shaya b'yada mikvar l'adun b'makom achar shlo hayso halacha yedua." And they got these principles from earlier received laws. And they then applied them other places where the law wasn't known. And he points out that after the 13 principles, there were in fact 32 principles. There's something called the 32 principles by which you interpret Agada, or the non-halachic parts of rabbinic literature. Where exactly these 32 principles are come from, where they're attested to in rabbinic literature, is a whole question I'm not going to get into, but it does seem to be something that is found in various places. So again, it seems like we've gone from 7 to 13 and then actually 13 to 32. So he says, how did those come to be? Shematza mikra she'ev sharlefarish be'ofen acher ela alpi zeh klal, that we come to a verse that we can only explain this way. And then we can use it in another place where it's not so clear what the verse means, except in a very difficult way of interpreting. Once we figured out this new principle, then we can interpret this pasuk very well. And in this way, we can actually add and explain it every generation, even though it wasn't explained before. And this is all within the commandment that we can do, that we keep and we make. And I think what the Netziv is essentially saying here is something in some ways that is somewhat radical from a traditional perspective. He's saying that we actually not only grow halacha based on received principles, but we grow principles, that we can learn one principle from another principle, we can come out with new principles. And this is, he says, something that can happen b'chol dor, in every generation, that new principles for interpreting halacha and coming up with new laws can be established. I think he says this also more succinctly in his commentary on Vayikra. I brought in the second part of source 7 here. Kamosha hosiv tan debei Rabbi Yishmael yugimel midos. That Rabbi Yishmael added, actually, and got to 13 midos. Midchila hayu sheva midos, shevi hu azak. And there were only 7 originally. Kedetayim vitosefta Sanhedrin, v'kama mekomas, and other places. V'achar tan debei Rabbi Yishmael, nitosfu ol klalim. But Rabbi Yishmael's base medrash added other principles. V'hu al pi un mechadash, v'chol dor v'dor. And this is through new investigation in every generation. So it seems like the Netziv is saying here is that the way to resolve the contradiction between 7 principles to 13 principles and maybe to 32 principles to say, sure, that these were added to, that what was handed down at Har Sinai was maybe much smaller, a much smaller toolbox, and that over time, that Chazal not only had the authority to learn new laws from what the principles they received, but actually to create new principles based on what they had received. And he's acknowledging then that Chazal are quite creative. And I think that by focusing on the importance of the creative process, what he is downplaying received tradition, but at the same time he's upping the authority of the rabbis to do this. And he's saying that I don't think Nassim would ever say like the rabbis have gone wrong. I think he believed very much in the process and felt that the rabbis were doing based on what was handed down at Sinai and what should be done throughout the generations, but he saw it more flexibly and more creatively. So if we want to give a response, and the Netziv isn't directly responding to reform, but if we want to give a response based on the Netziv, I think we would say that, yeah, okay, maybe Chazal's drashot don't always seem logical to us. But that's not the point. Chazal had the authority to interpret. That was something that was given to them and granted them in every generation going forward, to come up with new laws based on the needs of the time. And we saw a little bit of this last time when we talked about Rav Yosef Albo in the 15th century in his Sefer HaIkarim. He was saying something somewhat similar. He was saying that there was a need for things to develop flexibly over time. But I think where the Nassib goes far is he's saying that there's a lot more flexibility and even principles of interpretation can be recreated over time. Again, that's quite a bit, maybe a little complex. So I just want to pause for a minute and give anyone a chance to ask anything or make any comments.
You didn't mean recreate it. You meant create it. In other words, it's an iterative process.
Yes.
Each generation expands on the previous generation, thereby creating, as it were, new principles.
Yeah, maybe I was speaking too fast. I meant to say creative, yeah. And I agree, it's an iterative process. Yes. So let me then move on to my last source here. And this is Rav Moshe Feinstein. Let me actually say just one more thing first, actually. I also want to make clear, I don't think that like the Netziv is saying that let's just do whatever we want, kind of, that every generation, even now, we can just sort of keep rethinking the halachic system. I think that might be something the reform in Germany were saying at that time, but I don't think he would agree with that. What I think he would say is that Chazal, at least, in an earlier period, there was a certain flexibility. Maybe things have got somewhat less flexible, but I think he would still say that there is still a creative process going on, even if the dynamics of that process have changed, even if maybe some things have been set down and can't be changed at this point, but to a certain extent, that creative process still does continue. And I think what we see actually, Rav Moshe Feinstein really did feel that way, that there was a certain ability for the creative process to continue, even in modern times. Because this is what he writes in his introduction to the Igra of Moshe, his Chuvot. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was a very important posek in America in the 20th century, and his Shilas to Chuvos, Igra of Moshe, are a very, very important source for rabbis today in dealing with a lot of contemporary halachic questions. And in the beginning, in his introduction, he's dealing with the question of, what gives me the right to do this? Why can't I keep writing new halachic ideas? And his answer that he essentially comes to is because that's what you do, that the Torah continues to grow and expand, even in modern times. And it's kind of an involved piece here. But he's dealing with the Gemara that we saw in the first class, one of the Gemaras we saw in the first class, the one in Menachos, about how Moshe Rabbeinu is going to Rabbi Akiva's class, and he's not understanding what Rabbi Akiva is saying. But then eventually he's told that everything was really Misinai, even the things that he hadn't heard, even the things he hadn't learned, in some basic aspect are still connected to Har Sinai and are still a result of that process that started with Sinai. And what Rav Moshe is particularly interested in is, what about these crowns on the letters? Why do we need these crowns on the letters? Because that was a big part of that Gemara, that was talking about how Rabbi Akiva was going to darshan, he was going to interpret these crowns. And he says over here, Avalafi Masha Kasavti, just in the middle of the first line there, Avalafi Masha Biarti Miduyak Miloshan Kasarim, this language of crowns, what are the crowns?
Shinimsa Shashemis Baruch Hashem. Torn motion tech. I said he wasn't available for the
crown. That Hashem made the letters of the Torah like kings with crowns. Later rabbis and sages are going to interpret the letters of the Torah. Because Shahaya Machlokis Yasu Kafia Fanas Rov Chachmea Torah. And even if they haven't gotten things right, they're going to be interpreting the Torah. Even if it's not what Hashem initially intended. That Hashem basically handed things over to the rabbis to understand according to their understanding, and they didn't explain everything. Because it's not in heaven. Shloba Shemaim he. Elahiski mitchila avanas uperish chachmei Torah v'nimsa shiosius haTorah hei malachim. And that God agreed initially to the explanation of the rabbis, and we find that the letters are like kings. So shiosin kafim ma shemashma meaTorah lechachmei Torah, that they kind of do what the rabbis want them to do. Afshu ulay lo hayazek avanas v'shem yisbarach. Even though this wasn't Hashem's intent. V'zehu perush mima akev. And this is why when Moshe asked, who's holding you back from giving the Torah without the crowns? Shemosha Shah Lama Osa Kadosh Baruch Hu Ostios Lamalachim Shiasu Kfi Mashmaos HaChachamim Baloshon HaKasva Mosar. Moshe was asking, why are the letters like crowns? Why do they follow what the rabbis want them to do? Demima Akev Shach Techto Baofen Shlo Yeh Efshar Lefarish Rak Derech Echad Kavanas Chamitis. Why didn't you make them so they only have one meaning, one interpretation? Why do you make the letters like kings that they sometimes do what God wanted? That because of this is going to be much more halacha. That the Torah started out in a way small, but it grows and it grows. Because the Torah is without any boundary. So I think what Rav Moshe is saying here is that he's celebrating the creative process. Okay. So can you still hear me? Yeah. Okay. So I think what Rav Moshe is saying here is that there's something to be celebrated in this creative process. That when God handed over the Torah to the sages to interpret, that sometimes things might not turn out the way God even intended, but that nevertheless, that is the way God intended, because God intended the Torah to grow in every generation, and God intended there to halacha to be a creative process. And that's why he says he can continue to write new tshuvot and come up with new halacha because of that process that's built into the Torah from the start. And I think this is in some ways similar to what the Netziv was saying, that he's celebrating, that he's answering in a way those who might challenge halachic process and say it's not working out right and it's not logical by playing up the creativity that is inherent in the ability to interpret halacha anew and the authority of the rabbis to do that. I think this is going to be a good foundation for our last class, because in our last class, we're going to go back to some of the questions we raised in our first class about drawing a line between the times of Tanakh and the times of today. Because in our first class, we looked at things where it seemed like people were not following what was written in the Torah, or certainly not interpreting it in the way Chazal, our sages, interpreted it later. And we have to figure out how to deal with that. How do we deal with the fact that we don't see a lot of evidence of a Torah Shebaal Peh in Tanakh itself? And I think in addressing that question, we're really going to have to lean very heavily on some of these ideas about the importance of the creative process and the creative process being built into the Sinaitic revelation, of it being part and parcel of that. So when we look in the next class at Rav Kook and Rav Tzedek HaKohen of Lublin, they're going to say these things more explicitly about God's role in setting in place this process, which allows the Torah Shebaal Peh to develop. Okay, so thank you again, everyone. And let me address some final questions. Here's a question. Couldn't the reformers claim the same authority to be flexible in answer to the times? Yes, that's a really good point. And I think they could. And I think that's some of what makes this question such a difficult question. Because I think they could say that built into the Torah is this ability to be flexible. And I think to a certain point, the Orthodox would agree. The question is, where do you draw that line? And I don't know. You can probably draw that line in different places. I think for me, at least, I mean, I'm an Orthodox Jew. I do believe in this process. I do believe we've gotten somewhere to a certain extent that we're supposed to be. But I think the reason it's a difficult question is because you can come up with different answers. But I do believe, you know, in the authority of our sages and the way they've interpreted and the power of that tradition. But there can be perhaps different answers.
But there's a difference between interpreting the tradition and throwing it away, which is, I think, the real difference between reform and Orthodox.
Okay, Marty brings up a good point also, which I think is important to highlight, that he says that there's a difference between interpreting that tradition and throwing it away. And I guess what, Marty, what you're saying is you feel reform was basically getting rid of too much. And I think that's certainly part of the consideration. You have to kind of figure out how much to change in any given time. And like, certainly, you know, I think, I'm Orthodox. I'm coming from that perspective. I think that, yeah, sure. I think reform is throwing away a lot, too much of the tradition at once.
But the way I look at it, it's not only a matter of degree and amount, it's a matter of going away with the process to saying that the Torah is not divine.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It's a theoretical question more than a question of, you know, you've gone too far. If they want to go back and go, you know, I haven't done this in a long time. In August of 1966, Commentary Magazine did a whole issue on this state of Jewish belief. And if you go back to that, you can see that. And I've always thought if they did it, that somebody should do that cinema again.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, I think what you're saying is that to an extent, reform is also that there's a lot of other theological issues bound up in this, not just that they're going too far in a halachic perspective or with the halachic process, but that also the divinity of the Torah is being called into question. Yeah, sure, those are all issues. with that approach. And I think, thank you for bringing that up. I do appreciate that. I think there was one other question here in the chat or comment about, Seymour says, that's exactly what the conservative early rabbi said, that the process was creative and it could both conserve and create. Sure. I think that's what they were saying early on. I mean, this is like a really interesting issue and a really big issue though, about how you draw those lines and how you figure out how to do it. Did the conservative approach work though? And that's a question you kind of have to ask yourself. Like, did their balance that they struck, did that then sort of lead to a strong halacha community? I don't know. I mean, I think that those are all things you have to kind of consider though. And I think though that the orthodox approach has always been to have it develop as organically as possible and not to talk about so much what you're doing. Again, you can argue again, is that good or bad? But I think a lot of orthodox post-Kohen rabbis are not acknowledging, even if there is change going on to a certain respect, to a certain extent, they're not acknowledging that change necessarily. And maybe you could argue that's how, part of the way it works. Is that if you let it develop organically, then it tends to work out better than if you do it explicitly. But I mean, I can't really address all those issues in this class, but I think those are all the right questions to be asking about the halachic process. Okay, so thank you everyone again so much for coming, and I really look forward to seeing you all at the last class next Monday, where hopefully we'll tie up some of these issues to some extent.
Thank you.
Thank you everyone for coming. I'm so sorry. I realized I was typing on my computer, and that meant I was interrupting with some distraction at the end. Please forgive me. Slicha.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you all.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful week, and we will see you for the last class in this series next week, same time, same bat channel. All the best. Have a wonderful week. Shavuot Tov. Stay safe and stay well. Bye, everybody.